Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the greatest sports podcast in the Metro Detroit area. I'm your host, Connor. It's Teeing It Up with CNV. I'm the C, as always, with my co-host, the V of CNV. Vladdy, what's going on, man? How have you been since our last episode?
I'm doing well. I'm kind of at the end of my short work week, so when people listen to this tomorrow or in kind of the upcoming week, I'll be kind of done with the work week. We golfed this past weekend, and then I played Saturday as well, and I tied my career best, but this time it was in the elements. So I think I played probably my best round of golf this past Saturday, where tied my career best of an 85. And the last six holes were raining, not hard, but it was actually something you didn't have to account for, you had to deal with. So I'm proud of myself there. I feel like I'm in pretty good golf form right now, which might also kind of be a bad thing. I know you and I are a team for the Spartan Invitational, and I don't want to be peaking too early. We don't want none of that. Nope, we don't want no Buffalo Bills here. We want to be the Kansas City Chiefs. We got to peak at the right time.
No, I agree, and it's good because I'm not. I only played with you on Friday, and I haven't been playing much, and when I did play on Friday, I was not in midseason form. So at least one of us can maybe be peaking at that time. But did you play Blackhurst again on Saturday?
We Black Heath, but yes,
Black
we did
Heath,
play that
sorry.
Back to back. So
okay, yeah, nice fun track to go play
I
at.
mean, yeah, it's the easiest course around, simple, cheap, and if you need to kill some time, it's perfect.
Yeah, it wasn't quite as easy as I remembered, but. I think that's just hit. Like I said, when we played, it's somewhat hard second shots for that place, but easy visuals for most of those tee
I
shots.
also think that for me personally, I know we've mentioned this with you and with Northville Feegs as the lefties. The course does kind of help me out a little bit more than you guys, where OB left on the first couple holes, where that's
Yeah.
not a problem for me because I don't think I've put a tee shot left in my entire golf career. So I kind of do have that added benefit.
No, but we love to see you. You were striking the ball good on Friday. Good to see you tie career best Saturday. We got a win in our match on Friday also, so that's always good. You can't beat us as a tandem. This podcast doesn't do a whole lot of losing on the golf course,
Not
so
at all.
that's good. So speaking of the golf course, we're going to get
Yes.
into the U.S. Open preview. That starts tomorrow or today when you guys listen to it. We're also going to touch on both of the states of the NHL and NBA playoffs. They're both in the finals. They've both been duds this far, but we're going to kind of cover it. So I guess I can start in the NHL if you're ready to get into the topics for today.
Do we want to just start with the golf you mentioned? I thought you said we were gonna start with the golf.
Oh yeah, we could start with the golf. That works.
I was just gonna say, so I have a little bit of kind of a rant, not necessarily a rant here, but something that I was thinking about just watching some of the videos, and I was gonna throw it out there and I'll see what you say. So US Open at Pinehurst, third major of the year. This is usually, or the US Open's usually regarded as the toughest major because the USGA claims that they want to put their big boy pants on and make it hell for the golfers. And we'll see what happens, but I'm starting to get tired of that narrative. We haven't had a near par winner, which is what the USGA claims they want their winner to be, since 2018, which was Brooks at plus one. Since then, the closest has been minus six a couple of times. Last year, oh my God, it was the hardest thing ever. They had 100,000 feet long rough, and then two guys came out and shot an opening 62
Yeah,
at the
last year
US
was a
Open.
flop in general,
Yes,
the U.S.
but
Open.
I guess where I'm going with this, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend it's just the courses thing. Obviously, part of it is these guys are just so good, and the
Yeah.
technology has gotten so far that they can do things that they couldn't do 10, 15 years ago. But I'm tired of this, oh my God, it's so tough. And you see these videos where the ball lands on the green, and then it just rolls off the green, and then it never seems to actually happen in the actual round of golf because they probably water it and slow the greens down. And as always, they talk about the roughs, and maybe not Pinehurst because they do have a little bit more kind of bunker and a desert more like vibe on kind of your sides. But they always talk about this 17,000-foot rough, and then they cut it right before the tournament starts, and the rough that's left just gets trampled by the fans. I don't know. Maybe I'm just reading too far into the last couple of years, but I'm tired of this narrative that the U.S. Open is this incredibly hard thing, and oh my God, none of these guys can do it because they come out and they assault the course every year. And again, I don't know if this is the course's problem or the narrative's problem or just we have to give credit to the golfers because they are that good, but I am tired of seeing this every single year.
I have a couple of thoughts on that, in that I kind of agree and kind of don't agree. I said this with the PGA preview, and Valhalla was an exception because that ended up just being a birdie fest, with Schauffele winning in the -20s. The PGA had kind of outdone the US Open in terms of difficulty the last couple years. Oak Hill, I believe Brooks Koepka won at -5. Obviously, Wyndham Clark, I think, was -9 or -10 last year when he won at LACC, which is all around kind of a loss for the USGA as far as that event, any kind of the crowds they got, let alone the course itself. And prior to Oak Hill, you obviously had, why am I blanking on it? The place in Oklahoma City where Justin Thomas won at -5 in a playoff,
The
also
country club,
outdid.
right?
The what?
Wasn't it like just the country club or some weird name like that?
No, that was the US Open that year, and that's what I was gonna get into. That was also kind of right around the same score. I believe Fitzpatrick won -6, -5, which is kind of going into my next point, where I think you put too little credit, and you mentioned it and gave some credit to it, is I just think they're that good. That they're just getting better and better, and the technology is so good with how good they are that it's just like it simply can't be done anymore. Like having a tournament where a winner is going to shoot +1 just can't be done anymore. And their response to that is everything that they can do. Let's make it harder. Let's roll back the golf balls. It's kind of their biggest response now. But I do think Pinehurst is not necessarily. Unlike the last two, where LACC was very forgiving, you could kind of bomb and drive. Same with past ones like Wingfoot, where Bryson won in 2021, or sorry, 2020, and where Rahm won at Shinnecock in 2021. These aren't quite as their Pinehurst is not going to be a bomb and play. I do see this being more like a Brookline, the country that's the country club, the one in Boston that Fitzpatrick won 2 years ago, where the winner is going to be -5 or below. Pinehurst is hard. It plays hard in general. I do kind of think there's a response by the USGA this year where you're right, that they've kind of gotten their put to the test as far as the players have kind of outdone the course for the last 3 years, probably 4 years now. And Pinehurst is kind of a perfect venue to do it. It's an anchor spot. You mentioned how it's kind of is no rough really at Pinehurst. It's relatively narrow fairways, and then it's just sand. I know the sand is considered a little harder than like maybe your average bunker shot, but it's much closer to that than actually hitting on grass. And it's a second shot course, so that's why I'll get into my predictions and who I like because of that. In that the greens are all protected, they're all false fronts, they're all reverse bulls. So when you see those pictures or those videos of the ball rolling off the green, I believe it a little more maybe than past years because that's what this event and this course is known for. The last time they hosted a major, I can't remember his name, I think it was 2016. He famously won pretty much Texas wedging it the entire time. He only used putter off the green, and that's how he won. You saw a lot of guys in practice rounds from what I'm seeing. It's a lot of bump and run. They're saying that the grass is much more friendlier than the last time that they played there around the greens, actually, and that it's harder for these guys to chip or even to putt it because it's longer fairway grass now. So you're going to see a lot of, they mentioned Tiger doing a lot of bumping and running, and that's kind of the consensus around. You're going to have to see a lot of creative shots if you do miss greens. So I think this has potential to be a low round, but also it's a well-known course. A lot of those guys have probably played it a lot, so to where I could also see it being, 7, 8, 9 winning this one again. But it's not going to be the birdie fest you saw at Valhalla a couple weeks back. But I do agree with you that the USGA has kind of gotten their mouths put into their chests, so to speak, in terms of the players just kind of outdoing what anything that the USGA can do.
I guess in terms of that's kind of my or the topic of my rant. Maybe we get to the actual golfers. It's very tough to pick anyone except for Scottie Scheffler. He's made, I mean, not
Yeah.
that golf is the most exciting thing to watch on planet Earth, but he's made it so monotonous. He won at the Memorial this past weekend and nobody even knew it was going on. I think I
No,
saw
with
he
his B
shot,
game.
yeah, no, I was gonna say, I saw he shot a plus two final round, which was like his worst round in months, and he still won.
Yeah, the Marion played, I want to say 3 over par on Sunday. And there was a lot of talk of it being mentioned as like a major course. Obviously, it's hard because the Memorial is the year before or the week before the US Open and only 2 weeks after the PGA, which would be the two events that it'd be considered for. But it's repeatedly turned up low single digit winners, and it kind of ate everybody up on Sunday. So sorry, just to interject, but an interesting thought for that course. That's obviously the Jack Nicklaus course.
Yes.
But yeah, also, it's funny you mentioned Scottie Scheffler. Oh, it's not funny. You have to. It's no longer who do you think is going to win. It's who do you think has the best chance of giving Scottie Scheffler a run for his money. That's kind of that's kind of where we're at as far as picks in these majors.
Yeah.
So do you have some names you like this weekend that you think are going to compete with Scottie?
I'll tell you who I won't pick, and that's Jon Rahm because he
Oh,
withdrew
yep.
yesterday with, I don't know if you saw the statement. That was one of the crazy, it was, they talk about him having some kind of like toe issue, and then they put way too much detail into the statement of like what's actually wrong with his toes. I
Yeah,
don't know.
some disgusting blitzer or
Yeah,
something.
I was like, dude, just say he withdrew. That's all we need to know. Nobody cares about my man's toes, but it's not going to be Jon Rahm. I guess for shits and giggles, let me throw out Bryson. He's competed in both of the majors so far. We talked about him at the PGA, how he's kind of become the most entertaining golfer in the world, the most engaging golfer in the world. And there's one statistic I saw, which like with kind of the way the greens are perceived to be, is it should favor people who have a high trajectory of a shot, and it doesn't get any higher trajectory of a shot than Bryson DeChambeau. So if that is
Yeah.
indeed the case, and he's able to kind of gain an advantage there just based on how he typically plays, maybe he can compete. But give me him. Give me Cam Smith for shits and giggles, because I haven't heard that name in a couple of years, since he stole the Open from Rory. And that's it. I don't really know what else to say at this point, because like you said, it's Scotty versus the world.
Yeah, the Bryson name is awesome. He's had a great season, and I think he's fully back to being despite what the world golf rankings say, a true top 10 in the world. He's admitted this isn't the same course as maybe past years as far as suiting his game, because like I said, it isn't necessarily a bomb and play, bomb and hit course. It's a very second shot course. But he's obviously with those weird lofted wedges and a stock pitching wedge is 205 yards for him or something ridiculous. It's going to find a way to make that happen. I like that. A name I really like is Colin Morikawa. After a lat bad 2023 by his standards, he's kind of come back. And if it weren't for Scottie Scheffler be having the not breakout season because he's a multi-major champion, but breakout season and the season that everybody's talking about, he was in the last. He gave Scottie a run for his money last week, finishing second at the Memorial. He was in the last group with Schauffele in the PGAs. He finished T3 at the Masters. He's only missed one cut this entire year. And he is one of the best ball strikers and iron players in the world. And this is a course where that is going to be rewarded heavily. He's hot. He's having a great year. He's finally back to what he was 2 and 3 years ago. People forget he's a year younger than Scottie Scheffler and has just as many major championships as him. He came onto the tour and tied Tiger Woods for most consecutive cuts to start a career on the tour. This is one of the world's elite players. He's back to seventh in the world as after kind of being as high as 20 in the low 20s last year, has made his way back up to the top. And I think this is a course and he's playing well enough for him to have a chance to compete.
Yeah, that's all I really have for the golf.
Yeah, I mean, I'll throw in like Xander's playing well, great ball striker. A guy who I don't like, but is my bonus guy because you just kind of have to have him and everything is. I don't like Brooks Koepka at all this week. I don't think this is a course or a spot for him. I don't know. There's certain guys you just don't really see winning this, and that he's one of them for me, even though I do root for him. As far as the Tiger talk, I've heard this is one of the easiest walks of any major course that they run through. It's flat and it's very hot. It's going to be in the 90s, which I know he's kind of sweaty tiger now, but he's also when you have mechanical backs, it's hard to wake up for that early April Masters round when it's 45 degrees in the morning. He's not going to have that problem here. Everything's going to be warm and loose, and he's going to be able to get into a feel and a flow of things very quickly with the body. And that being an easy walk, I think this is as good a chance as any for him to finish four rounds and make the cut.
Honestly, I'm gonna not necessarily disagree, but I'm kind of tired of talking about it. I know you have to because it is Tiger, but I think I saw something with the US Open stat was he's had like 12 or 13 straight rounds at the majors that have been over par. Go away.
Oh, he's a sideshow at this point. I'm just saying, like, as far as his storyline
Yeah, I get
favors
it.
well for him, maybe. I guess I hate saying this because I also don't really like talking about it at this point. But like, what's a good weekend? Making the cut and finishing four rounds, I think. Yeah. So, and which is not something we're even going to mention this time next week. So.
To the
That's it. That's
basketball,
all I
yeah,
got on
to
the
the
US
basketball
Open.
and to the hockey. Where do we
Yeah.
start?
I can quickly run through the hockey. It's 2-0 right now as we speak. Game one, Florida wins 3-0. They kind of Edmonton comes out hot. They, I will say, actually outplayed Florida for a good chunk of that game. Florida just plays, and I'm gonna say this three times in a 3-minute lecture on these two games. Florida just plays playoff hockey. They're super hard to play against. They're really hard to get into good scoring chances against in their defensive zone, Edmonton's offensive zone. And that's why Edmonton's only scored one goal through two games. So they win that game 3-0, just kind of a grind it out. Edmonton clearly actually is probably the faster and quicker team. And I think maybe Florida was somewhat surprised by that in game one, but was able to sh shut it down. On top of that, getting some very good saves from Bobrovsky. I mentioned in the conference finals how, I think when Feegs was on a couple weeks ago, of the four goalies left, you could probably make an argument for three of those four being in the top four goalies in the entire league. Maybe they're not, but you can make an argument for it. And the only one that's left off that list is Edmonton Stuart Skinner, who's been fine and not the problem in this series, but Bobrovsky has played every bit of that top four goalie in the league, and that definitely showed out in game one. He had some huge saves, 32 sh save shutout in a Stanley Cup game is huge and very hard to do. So if he's on his game the rest of the series, it's going to be over quickly. Game two, another Florida win. This one was not necessarily, I think you could argue if you were Edmonton, you had a chance to win that game despite a 3-0 score. Game two was not that. Florida looked every bit of the playoff grind it down. They looked more physical. They looked harder to play against. They looked better offensively. They looked pretty much everywhere. And that's after Edmonton started the game off 1-0. You kind of thought maybe Edmonton could get into a role and maybe steal one on the road. But then Florida came out and just actually purely dominated them the rest of this game. Final score 4-1. This game heads to Edmonton tomorrow night or tonight as you're listening to it. Of the NBA and the NHL, I'm going to give Edmonton the higher chance. Their barn and their place, and Edmonton in general, is very ready for a Stanley Cup to come back and host a Stanley Cup final, let alone win one. So I want to see, it's like the old expression, the series doesn't start till the home team loses. I want to see Edmonton lose game three. Obviously, when you go down 3-0, it's super easy to say they have no chance now, but I want to see Edmonton lose tomorrow night and to really count them out. It's going to be Florida. They're just the best playoff team the whole year. They have been. They muck it up. All their good players are physical and rats at the same time. They're playoff gamers. Barkov is the best two-way forward in the league right now. And on top of that, they have goalie Bob Bobrovsky. So that is the NHL in a nutshell right now. We'll send it over to correspondent Vladdy for the NBA.
Yeah, The first two games have happened. Game three is tonight as we record this. It starts in about half hour. I think it starts in an hour. I think it's at 8:30 tip off. And it just looks like the Celtics are too much for the Luka Doncic Mavs. The Celtics can play eight, nine players deep, and all of them are capable of playing, and the Mavs cannot. And I'll talk a little bit about more of what's happened afterwards. I want to kind of quickly run through kind of the games. Game one is kind of tough to kind of call some kind of remote game because Kristaps Porzingis was floating. He had elevated to God status for about 20 real life minutes in that first quarter, where everything that kind of came his way on the offensive end was in, and everything that came his way on the defensive end was blocked. And I think the Celtics were able to open up that 20-point lead at the end of the first quarter and kind of just not even like leaned on them. They just sat there and killed the game. I mean, Dallas at one point was able to make it an 8-point lead. Only they cut it that much. But when you go down by 30, you can't really come back because you have to be so perfect for so long, and the other team has to be so imperfect for so long that there's nothing you can do about it. So I don't want to sit here and pretend like that's something that you can really draw parallels from, because again, what Kristaps Porzingis did cannot be replicated. It can't. Game two, though, is a little bit more of kind of what you would expect. Some back and forth. Luka coming out hot. I think he dropped 20 in the first quarter. And then just kind of the team came up to play, and the team ended up taking a lead. And I mean, I guess Dallas was able to keep it at a range where it was quote unquote uncomfortable, because you never know when a team can go on a run in the NBA. But it's a team versus a player. I know when we talked about this, we thought it was two players. It's not two players, it's one. And I'll get to the one who has not pulled his weight. But it's been a team versus a player. We'll see what happens tonight in game three. Kristaps Porzingis is out officially for the game, so maybe that helps Dallas a little bit, so they can actually attack the rim without just getting everything eaten by that man. But let's get to actual the nitty-gritty of what's going on. The Celtics game plan has become, or not become, has been, we're gonna let Luka be Luka, and nobody else is gonna score on us. They don't double team him, they don't blitz him. They kind of just say, you know what? You're tall, you're big, you want to post up some guard like Peyton Pritchard or someone you're taller than, go for it. Take your 2 points. We're perfectly okay with that. Nobody else is gonna beat us. And that's all the Mavs have. There's no other offense because the only other creator that team has, Kyrie Irving, has sold the series so
Goes.
far. The Celtics
He's bringing a
defense.
championship home to Boston, like he promised.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah. I mean, the Celtics defense, they rotate whoever on Luka. It's actually impressive. They don't even care. It could be Peyton Pritchard, as I mentioned. It could be Al Horford. It could be Brown or Tatum. They sit there. They're like, whoever ends up on them, go for it. And they've all actually done a pretty good job. Luka has had to kind of work for his shots. Like, he does have that little fadeaway, almost kind of like a Dirk. But it's not just some empty layup. On the offensive end, the Celtics have done what the Timberwolves didn't, and that is make Luka Doncic actively try to defend. And I say try because he's not. I saw a stat in game two. He got blown by on 13 drives. That is the worst statistic, I think, in NBA Finals history, I think, is what I saw. The Celtics also, on the offensive end, have their little five-out offense, which has greatly diminished the impacts that Daniel Gafford or Derek Lively can have because they are rim protectors. But you can't really be a rim protector if you're getting pulled out to the three-point line and someone blows by you with some ball movement and they give up empty layups. So it's been a matchup nightmare so far. Getting to Kyrie specifically, it's so bad. And we talked about this last week, how Kyrie has kind of looked like the grown-up, the he understands his role with Luka. He's been the guy this playoff series or playoffs kind of just stretch, and all of that has gone out the window. I don't know if it's because it's Boston, his old team, or because it's those fans who he hates. He has completely reverted to head case, Mr. Victim. I need to scream and have dumbass antics. I don't know if you saw in the after game one, he or I don't know if he tweeted out or he responded to some interview question, and it was like, "Oh yeah, I expected the crowd to be louder after game one." It's like, dude, he lost by 50. What do you want him to do? And then after game two, he's walking off the court after they get beat again. He's flashing a little five at the crowd, like as if to signify, yeah, we'll be back here. It's like, first of all, you might not. And second of all, if you do, it'll almost certainly be for a closeout game because he has been that bad.
Oh, yes.
Like nobody has ever doubted this guy's skill. He is an all-time Hall of Fame talent with the basketball in his hands, probably the greatest layup package of all time. But the detriments have always been mental and behavioral. And I don't know what's going on. If he's, like I said, maybe he's opened up old wounds, quote unquote, but he's just not there. It's only been two games. As you mentioned, the series don't really start until someone steals a game on the road. But I don't know what to say. It's so sad how uncompetitive and just useless he's been. So I don't really have much more than that. Again, game three is going to happen tonight. Kristaps Porzingis is out, so there's a nice little matchup advantage for the Cel or for the Mavericks. We'll see what happens, but this looks like it'll be over in four. It's bad.
Yeah, and it's with Jason Tatum, was not very good in game one, and I mean he has the double double with I think 12 assists and 19 or 20 points, but not really scoring the basketball like he does at or shooting the ball like he does at any clip of what's considered normal for him. In fact, game two was kind of the Drew Holiday game, and it's
Oh,
just goes
no.
back to like you said, it's the role players and the team. For the Celtics is just leaps and bounds ahead of anybody not named Luka Doncic on the Dallas Mavericks.
And I mean, you want to mention Tatum. We can lump Brown in there. Brown's kind of been their big boy this playoff season, which I guess kudos to him because he's gotten slandered a lot by people, myself included. But neither of those two guys were the best player on the court in either of the two games. It was Kristaps Porzingis in game one, and as you mentioned, Jrue Holiday in game two. It is the perfect kind of storm of a team. Give some credit to Brad Stevens, who made the moves this offseason to get Porzingis and then get Holiday and still somehow end up with a first round pick. I forget the exact move that he made to get Porzingis on that team. And then he got like dealt two first round picks. I forget who he sent away, but was it Robert Williams? I'm doing this on the fly, so my apologies if I missed something, but major kudos to Brad Stevens for kind of putting that team together.
Did he come straight from Dallas, Kristaps Porzingis, or was there a
No, he was elsewhere.
Because it was New York, then Dallas.
Maybe, no, I mean, maybe he
I feel
didn't.
like there was. I feel like there was a stop in between. Because
I
I feel
think
like
there was.
he would have been talked about more when Kyrie got traded there.
I agree. I'm totally blanking. I'm actually probably gonna look at this once we're done and just kind of get an idea of how this team was put together. Because again, this team is loaded. I don't know how they do it. Good for them. But I can see this series ending in four. Is just kind of what I will say for
Yeah,
now.
and say they do win in four. Where is this team all time? They would have only lost two playoff games. Two or three?
I
Two.
mean, too, in terms of where they are all time, I think that's tough because as of right now, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are making history. They have not, like, when we look back at the KD Warriors, we're looking at guys at the end of their careers and we're like, holy shit, how did all three of those or all four of those guys that are all Hall of Famers end up on the same team? So I think it's tough to look at this team from a all-time perspective. But I think it becomes one of the deepest teams of all time. Maybe they don't have the three, four, five, or not five, because I don't think any team's ever had five Hall of Famers all kind of relatively in their prime, but they won't have the most star power that I've ever seen on a basketball team, but they might be one of the deeper ones that I've ever seen in the basketball team.
I guess that's more what I meant. Just given like how dominant the regular season was on top of a playoff run where you have two sweeps and don't go past five games in a series. But I only wanted to bring that up because like you said, it might be over by the time we next talk. So
Yeah, I have nothing else to mention. This is going to be one of our shortest episodes in probably over a year at this point, just because we've always had the football to bring us close to an hour, but I've got nothing else to say.
no, that's it. I wish, unfortunately, these series had a little more
Yeah.
to give us. But yeah, I don't have much. It's kind of Panthers and Boston territory. And that'll kind of walk us into the dead period of sports where we'll have to come up with stuff to talk about.
See, the dead period's not even that much. I mean, it's June, we got July, and then August when we can start talking about football again. So I don't
Yeah.
think it'll be that bad of a dead period. I'm sure with the holiday weekend we might miss an episode. So I don't think it'll be as bad as maybe in years past. But oh, I mean, I guess the one thing that I can talk about is we got international soccer tournaments this summer, the Euros and the Copa America. So I'm excited for those. Maybe we'll, if we're looking for some time, we'll talk about it. But
Isn't there an Olymp? Isn't there an Olymp? Isn't there
there is an
Olympics?
Olympics. Look at us. We filled the
Yeah.
dead period.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right. So I guess this doesn't mean as much as it usually does because it's been a short episode. But to those who made it this far, thank you very much. We appreciate you. I have nothing else to say.
Hugs and kisses. Bye.